Hello, I'm Dr. Bill Nelson, director of the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center at Johns Hopkins. Welcome to our new podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about proton radiation therapy with Dr. Ted DeWeese. Ted is the director of the Department of Radiation Oncology and Molecular Radiation Sciences and the vice president of interdisciplinary patient care for Johns Hopkins Medicine. An accomplished genitourinary radiation oncologist and radiation researcher, Ted is also a major international figure in his field. Today, we're going to be discussing proton therapy and the addition of a proton therapy center at Sibley Memorial Hospital in Washington, D.C. Ted and I discuss the benefits of targeted proton radiation therapy over conventional radiation and why it is essential that the Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center is adding this treatment option at Sibley. Dr. Theodore DeWeese, the Director of Radiation Oncology and Molecular Radiation Sciences at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and a member, of course, of the Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center. Ted, let's talk a little bit about radiation therapy generally and its uses in cancer. I don't think many people are as aware of how many people who are diagnosed with cancer benefit from radiation therapy. How many do so?
Well, thanks, Bill. That's a great question. About 60% of all patients diagnosed with cancer will receive radiation therapy at some point during their course of their care. More than half of whom will have it provided to them as a definitive treatment, that is to say, to cure them, and some other fraction of them will be used in a palliative sense, or that is to say, to relieve some of the symptoms. So the fact is, if you think about all the patients that are diagnosed with cancer in the United States per year, we're talking a huge number of patients that actually receive radiation therapy. So it is one of the three modalities, as you well know, to cure cancer: radiation, surgery, chemotherapy. And the more contemporary way, I think, to view it is that it's no longer usually one or the other of those three things. It's really a combination of those three that give the best outcomes.
So one of the very gratifying things, in especially over the last several years, is that the number of people who've heard those three words, you have cancer, who have survived their cancer and are now reentering the workforce, contributing to society and the like, is increasing to dramatic numbers. They say somewhere between 15 and 20 million. You'll hear estimates all over the map in between there, are cancer survivors. And what you're saying is many of these people have had radiation therapy contribute to this survivorship.
It is true. And you know, like with any therapy, particularly in cancer, as the technologies, as the therapies have advanced over time, the good news is that while there is more people being cured, there's also more people being cured and living with the toxicities of the care that are less than, say, their aunt and uncle or their grandparents did. And so, but as a technically based specialty, it's really incumbent upon us to try to use the most advanced technologies along with chemotherapy, along with surgery, to try to give the most optimal, not just quantity of life, but quality of life. And therein leads us to some of the things that we've been doing more recently with technology that indeed does minimize the amount of normal cells that are irradiated that might be injured and cause long-term side effects while still curing the cancer.
Well, that will prompt us to go back and think a little bit about what is radiation therapy, or what are the radiation therapies that are available. How do they work to destroy cancer cells, and what are we trying to avoid in terms of damaging normal tissues, and how are we doing so? So what is radiation therapy?
Well, that's a great question, and it is a very broad one. And in its broadest sense, of course, radiation is using either one, in the older sense, radioactive material that is brought out of the ground that's radioactive normally, and because it emits X-rays, if you place those sources of material inside a tumor, for example, you can deliver a very high dose of radiation inside the tumor, which is quite curative. And in fact, the most modern way, the most important way to treat virtually all women with cervical cancer, except those who have the early stage, is with radiation therapy. And in fact, if one does not use these small sources of radioactivity, sometimes called brachytherapy, with the Latin word brachy meaning close to or short distance, if you don't use that, women don't survive as frequently. So it's radioactive material placed directly in the tumor. Sometimes radiation can be in a more liquid form, believe it or not. You can make it into a solution, and it can be injected into the vein. And when it's incorporated with other things that target the tumor, for example, it might be with an antibody, for example, or other kind of molecule, it can be directed right to the tumor and deliver the radiation right on the cancer cell or in the tumor. So that's another form of brachytherapy.
So in this case, sometimes the radio emitters, if you will, are emitting X-rays. Are these the same kind of X-rays that are used to create X-ray images, let's say, of the chest or via a CAT scan? And if they are, how is it different when you're using it for therapeutic purposes as opposed to diagnostic purposes?
Yeah, that's a great question. It leads me right to where I was going to go, which is X-rays, if you remember, they're basically just a form of high energy. So we tend to see light waves because they're in a wavelength we can see. And the shorter that the wavelength becomes, we no longer can see it. For example, UV light, we can't visualize. And when it's extremely short, it's called an X-ray. And so X-rays are generated either through radioactive material, as I was just describing, and so it's emitting that X-ray, or it's generated from a machine. And that is exactly as you described originally, sort of to look inside the body, like a chest X-ray, or look at your arm, sort of to that degree. And then that has advanced over the years to things like CT scans that are very complicated computer-generated images that come from multiple X-rays. So indeed, an X-ray is everything from imaging through therapy. How do they differ, though, between an imaging X-ray and a therapeutic X-ray? Well, the imaging X-rays are not very powerful. They can certainly penetrate the body, powerful enough to do that and give an image, but they're not strong enough or of high energy enough to actually kill a cancer cell.
And in fact, actually, there's every attempt to make them even less powerful for safety purposes.
Very much.
Right?
The lower dose you can give, the better it should be. And with X-rays that are used to kill cancer, it's an interesting, when they're generated from a machine and pointed at a particular point in the body where the cancer resides, it's interesting because they actually enter the body. And then through a series of interactions with what we are mostly, which is water, believe it or not, right? Most of us, our body is water and the cells are water. The X-rays are so powerful that it splits the water molecule. And so now the water molecule is very unsteady. It doesn't like to be in that state. So it tries to find something to settle itself down with. And sometimes when it does that, it does it with the DNA inside the cell. And when it does it, it breaks the DNA. And if the DNA inside the cancer cell is broken, it can no longer replicate or divide again, and that actually kills the cancer cell. So that's actually how the X-rays work. Finally, and interestingly, there are one other way been done in the world to treat cancer, and that's called heavy ion therapy, the most common of which is a so-called proton therapy. So for the audience, they'll remember that everything in the universe is made of atoms. And those atoms get put together as molecules that then make up all the substance of the world. Well, at the atomic level, the inside of that atom is made of protons and neutrons and electrons. And these are these subatomic particles. So if we can split those things apart in a very safe way, then you can be left with, for example, a proton, which actually weighs something. It actually has a mass, and it actually has a charge on it, happens to be positively charged. So if those particles, like a proton, are sped up to high energy, they can enter the human body, and because we know exactly how to control their energy and speed, they can deposit the energy that kills the cancer right inside the cancer, and really no dose anywhere else. That's unlike an X-ray, which passes directly through the body, through the cancer, but off the other side, where the protons, no matter how you deliver them, you can calibrate their energy such that they only deposit their energy and kill inside the tumor. But it's a very sophisticated technology to do that.
Well, one of the things that's been quite amazing accompanying the information technology revolution has been the ability to take these X-rays and now protons and to aim them to very discrete points in space, both for depth of penetration and exactly to where the cancer is, hopefully exactly, even though it might be in a part of the body that moves a little bit and the like. The goal being to direct the radiation therapy that can damage the DNA, as you described, and kill the cancer cell, but hopefully have minimal perturbation of anything around that. How close are we to that in the perfect sense?
Right. That's a great question. Well, to expand that just a little bit for the listener, tumors are in the body in some specific orientation. And since we need to, no matter how the radiation is delivered, be able to target it, that's really based on a set of sophisticated scans before the patient's ever treated. So, for example, we would get a CT scan and often an MRI scan in exactly the position the patient's treated in. And then those images are fused together, sort of like that virtual reality business you see in movies and TV. So we know exactly, no matter how we look at the patient, we know precisely where in their body the tumor is relative to the normal cells around it. And so then using that, we use a set of supercomputers, which iterates the plan hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times to meet the most ideal way to deliver this radiation and meet all the objectives as I, as a physician, would suggest they need to be. And then I would review it, make whatever modifications, for example, that I think need to be made to that particular plan. And then right before we actually treat the patient, we do one more thing. Because this radiation is so sophisticated, so precise in doing that, we have to build a phantom, a fake patient, if you will, that has very precise electronics in it. And then we treat that with what we say we're going to do to the patient. So we can say, here's what we did. Here's this computer-generated plan. This is what we wanted to do. Is it correct before we ever treat the patient? That's why it takes a few days to a week or two to come up with this plan. Okay, so now the patient's ready to go. They come into the treatment room. They're lying there. We have a three-dimensional laser system get them all lined up just perfectly. They often have, the word is immobilization device. It's just a way to keep them from moving around unnecessarily. And then right before they're treated, we do one more thing. We need to reassure ourselves that the patient is indeed in the exact position that we said they were, so their cancer will be treated precisely. So we then have a CT scanner built into the machine. So we then take a quick CT scan of the patient in that position to show where the cancer is today relative to where we said it should be. And then those images get merged. And so we can make precision down to some of our equipment can do it in 1/10 of 1 millimeter accuracy.
So in this evolving way that radiation therapy is used to 1/10 of a millimeter accuracy, as you mentioned, being able to manipulate and steer protons to that level of accuracy is a wondrous new technology that's being explored and coming online in many different sites around the world. What is proton therapy going to really change the outcomes for, in your mind?
Well, that's a great question, Bill, because a lot gets talked about in the news and the media, and we'd love to stay away from the hyperbole that often accompanies new medical techniques and technologies. So the place where we are more than confident about its application, a lot of studies have been done, are in tumors that sit right next to very important other normal tissues, for example, like your eye or things in the brain or the spinal cord, just as a few examples. And I think one of the most important applications which has been seen and certainly documented is in the treatment of children. You can imagine that we want to minimize side effects in any patient. Treating children where their brains, for example, and other tissues are still growing, if we injured those unnecessarily in the attempt to cure them, that could have long-term consequences. So doing everything we can to minimize radiation going to places where we don't want it to be is important. And proton therapy to date is the most effective way to do that. And so just to give you a sense, children, and a study was done fairly recently, children who have brain tumors, and brain tumors are one of the more common types of malignancies that children can get, unfortunately. So radiation plays a critical role in the management of those children, and we know for many years they can be cured or have long-term survival. But the consequences were sometimes their intelligent quotient, their IQ, would be lower because of that treatment, and therefore there's a long-term consequence to that, right? They don't learn as well. They have less ability to be productive in society, and therefore, from a societal perspective, it's more costly. So doing everything up front, spending a little more money up front, can pay off in the long term. So the most recent study showed that the use of proton therapy in the treatment of children with brain tumors can reduce by nearly 50% the loss of IQ points. So you can imagine that a child no longer has to, and his or her parents have to worry so much about their ability to continue to live and grow in a normal society. The other piece of that isn't just the brain tissue itself, but you can imagine one of the most important attributes of learning is hearing. And so because children's heads are small, tumors in the brain, the other risk is treatment of portions of their hearing nerves. And if those hearing nerves are injured, they can't hear as well and therefore can't learn as well. And so the most recent data would show the use of proton therapy reduces that risk, again, probably about threefold. So it's an amazing thing what we're able to do.
So this is what the future is going to look like, and these are the kind of people who are going to be treated. Now, I'm pretty sure that I can't go onto the Amazon website and add a proton radiation therapy machine to my shopping chart before I check out. What's involved in the technology that can deliver protons to this accuracy to help children with IQ points, uveal melanomas in the eye, all these kind of things? What's involved in creating that technology? How big of a machine is it? What is it?
Well, Bill, you know, you may be able to do it. You know, your credit card may be able to hold more than others in their shopping cart to be able to buy one of these, but I'm not sure that's correct. But indeed, it is an enormous undertaking. Back to what I said, of course, if you're now having a subatomic particle, a proton, as small as it really is, you have to generate it. And so that comes from, believe it or not, hydrogen. And hydrogen is the most ubiquitous substance in the entire universe. About 75% of the universe is hydrogen. So if you just take hydrogen gas and you remove the electron from it, now you're left with a proton because that's the only thing that it is. And so if you put that proton into what's called a cyclotron, or a sometimes termed synchrotron, so that's basically a 16-foot diameter magnet that turns on and off very quickly, so it starts to accelerate this proton around and around and around really, really fast. And how fast is it? Well, in this 16 diameter circle that it's moving around, it will go 10 million times in 1 second around that diameter. Or put it another way, it can circle the Earth 5 times in 1 second. That's the speed of this proton. And so then that's removed from the cyclotron down a set of more magnetic devices and then into the patient's room. And in a very large, about 30-foot diameter iron framework, that proton is controlled to spin around the patient at any angle we would like it to and delivered to the patient. Other fascinating piece is that the technology to actually deliver to a patient, that last final step, has changed radically in just the last year or two. And what we have installed at Johns Hopkins is something called a pencil beam scanning, meaning that there's just a tiny little, if you can imagine, pencil width worth of protons coming out of the machine, and it is very rapidly, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times per second, scanning the tumor, going back and forth just to the edges of the tumor, top to bottom, in and out, so that the protons are delivered only inside the cancer and nowhere else outside.
This is color in the lines kind of logic.
It is a very much a stay in the lines kind of guy. That's the kind of guy I am. You don't want people going outside those lines. So the point of all that is, of course, to generate those protons, to get it to be able to have an energy that could circle the Earth 5 times in 1 second, and have a building that can hold a 30-foot diameter iron framework, this scaffolding, that can go around the patient and deliver that precisely within those dimensions we saw. That's an expensive bit of technology, both infrastructure, computer design, delivery modalities. And so, you know, in that $100 million range, be able to treat adults and children all in one facility. But what we think is so important is that, And what Hopkins does fundamentally is to do research to try to improve everything we do. So I believe we may be one of the only, if not the only, but certainly one of the only facilities in the United States that has a whole room dedicated only to doing research. That is to say, to do the cellular work, to do research on animals, to do the physics kind of research that's going to really help us refine and define who are the best patients to be treated by this technology. How do we integrate things like immunotherapy and some of the other exciting drugs? How are they going to work better with proton therapy than in either one individually? So that's what we're all about.
And what do you imagine are going to be the kind of innovations you'll see even in the short term? Are at the Proton Radiation Therapy Center with the research component, are we going to be thinking about treatment in a very different way, treating lung cancer, let's say, even though people have to breathe, but can we aim at the cancer in a limited number of fractions or something, limited number of visits to the machine? Where is that going to go, that you think?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Bill. Historically speaking, proton therapy, as we've talked a little bit already today, has been around the use in children. That will expand in the use of children for all the reasons I said. It's also been used a lot in men with prostate cancer. I think most of us who are oncologists, and certainly at my own clinical practice around prostate cancer, it's not clear proton therapy is a substantial advantage in that regard. And that's fine. Studies had to be done, but there's other ways that are equally efficacious. To your point, there are a lot of other things that require very high doses with very limited distribution of radiation in the head and neck, for example, at the base of the skull, where all the nerves come out, very complicated anatomy, in the lung and in the middle of the chest in the esophagus region, in the pancreas area, some of and in diseases of some of the back of the abdomen and in the limbs called sarcomas. Very, very hard to treat. You need a multimodality approach and using radiation that is a very high dose and very highly precise. So those are some of the diseases. But interestingly, you made an interesting point, Bill, about whether those things that might move, how do we control that? Well, our head of physics here at Johns Hopkins some years ago had invented a device that can control a patient's breathing. So the patient is trained to use this device, and when they're comfortable holding their breath, they just click a button, they hold their breath, the radiation beam comes on while, for example, the tumor in the lung has stopped moving. It can be treated, and when they're in need of a breath, they let go, the machine turns off, they start breathing again, and then when they're ready, they repeat that. So we're able to, if you will, gate the or control the radiation beam to the respiratory motion of the patient. And then finally, there's some even more exciting new adaptations of proton therapy that are coming online, which is to say, because protons, believe it or not, when they interact with human tissue, produce things like oxygen that's in a different state, a molecular state, if you will. And then, therefore, you can use a PET scan and see where the radiation was actually applied that minute or two before, because oxygen is now activated, and then in a real-time fashion start to think about how you might today deliver the dose in this way, but tomorrow use a slightly different dose, a slightly different angle of treatment, and a slightly different energy. And then over a course of care, using this molecular way to evaluate cancer cells and the tumors themselves, adapt the treatment to the most important one for that patient on the table today, not just the generic patient that's like him or her.
Well, of course, the Johns Hopkins proton radiation therapy is going to be sited down on the Sibley Hospital campus in the National Capital Region. One of the cancer efforts that's been very successful over the years at Sibley Hospital has been the treatment of women with breast cancer and women with gynecologic cancers. And there's been a lot of discussion in the breast cancer community that, along with the role of radiation therapy in conserving breast tissue, this sort of lumpectomy and breast conservation rather than removing the breast, that there may be a real advantage to use proton radiation therapy, particularly in the treatment of left breast cancer versus right breast cancer. How does that make sense?
Yeah, sort of on first blush may not make too much sense, but indeed, I think most people have enough sophistication around their own anatomy that they would know that the heart sits mostly on the left side of the chest. And so therefore, If one were looking right under the ribs, of course, and the breast is attached right onto the chest wall, right under those ribs sits the heart. And so one of the long-term risks that people had been historically worried about in the treatment of women with left-sided breast cancer is that when the radiation has to treat the entire breast, that a portion of the front of the heart could receive radiation dose. And if that were true, which historically it was, with particularly using older techniques, then the risk of cardiovascular disease increases for things like, for example, a heart attack. So anything we can do to minimize that would be smart. Well, based on everything I've said today, you can imagine that use of proton therapy to treat the breast on the left side can effectively eliminate any radiation dose that goes to the heart. And so to be able to give a high dose that's very conformal to where the tumor was with zero dose to the heart makes very good sense. And I don't think it takes much of a rocket scientist to figure out no dose is better than any dose. And so the ability to do that, I think, is now quite important for us to study, and it's being studied at a few places select in the world right now. So we'll join in that effort when we're ready to treat.
Well, it sounds like overall this movement of radiation therapy to better aiming technologies with x-rays and then this new proton radiation therapy capabilities, which is just starting, if you will, to be refined in the way we believe it will be in the future, will be a part of this great trend where people are living longer lives with cancer and with less treatment-associated side effects, whether it's from laparoscopic surgery instead of a large incision, radiation therapy much more precisely aimed, sparing normal tissues like never before, targeted treatments that don't do so much damage to the rest of the body like chemotherapy did. Can you imagine a time in the future where being treated with cancer is far less the hassle that it is these days, and that when treatment is finished, people just jump back into the rest of their lives?
I think, Bill, that is, yes, I can envision it. And I would say that we're there to some degree on a few patients, and we are getting there for the vast majority. And I think the way you've described it, which is not just focusing on the cure of the cancer, that is, of course, paramount to us, the quality of life of any of our patients in the near and long term is very important. But part of that quality of life in the near term is to try to have this therapy, whatever that is, be minimally disruptive. No one likes to stop working if they don't have to stop doing the activities they'd like to do, to continue the relationships that they have. So a part of that equation in the radiation therapy domain is, can we using these kinds of high-end technologies like proton therapy, for example, give much greater dose per day because it's so much more accurate, and therefore we don't have to give as many number of days of treatment. And if that were true, then instead of having 7 or 8 weeks of treatment, it now goes down to 2 or 3 weeks of treatment. That is therefore less disruptive in any patient's life. And so most of those patients can work every day, and then they're back to their normal routine in less than a month.
So you've talked about just how big of an enterprise this is, or how big of a construction project this is. Where are we at? When is this going to open? What does it look like? I know you've been down there checking out to make sure the synchrotron's in the right place, all those magnets are set up correctly. Where are we at?
Well, I have been down there, Bill. The good news is I have a bunch of engineers and physicists who can actually take care of that latter point. But it is a very exciting time. As you said, Bill, the building is sited on the Sibley campus of Johns Hopkins. The building itself is about 80-some thousand square feet. It's very big. And has three rooms, one of which is dedicated to children, two towards adults, and as I noted earlier, we have a fourth room that's dedicated only to research. The building is complete. It has been now made watertight, as they say in the construction world. The synchrotron, that thing that has sped up the protons, is in place, and the very fancy magnets that drive the and guide the proton to the rooms is in place. And then one of the rooms has that large iron scaffolding, the gantry, is in place. So that equipment will continue to be installed until July or so of this year. And then Our team, along with the other engineers, will be working over about another 8 or 10 months for it to be what's called commissioned, to be sure it's actually working. We have all the parameters precisely done before we actually treat a patient, which will be about September 2019.
And then when it's fully commissioned and open for business, if you will, what will the experience be like for a patient who comes to the center for a radiation therapy treatment course?
Yeah, that's wonderful, Bill. Well, fortunately, we have a parking structure immediately adjacent to it, so the patients will park and walk directly into the building. And where they walk directly into it, fortunately, that is exactly where all of the reception area is. It's a self-contained building because all consultative services, the imaging that they require for all the treatment planning, all the planning is there, all the physicians are there, all the nurses are there. Our trainees from here in East Baltimore, Johns Hopkins, will be down there learning and training and helping out with the care. Our physicists and biologists will be down there. And all the course of care will be down there. So it is a fully operational, if you will, soup to nuts operation for the management of patients who require cancer care with protons.
But they won't be able to see the actual protons with their eye.
No, if they are, then it's one of those, as you see on the back of a van sometimes. If you can see this, you're too close. That's probably the case.
All right. Thank you, Ted. You've taught us a lot about radiation therapy. You've gotten us through our introductory physics course. And you've told us about how the Proton Radiation Therapy Center to be sited at the Sibley campus in Washington, D.C. is going to be an innovative site for improving radiation therapy for years to come. Thank you, Ted.
It's my pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. DeWeese. We'll have a lot more exciting information about our proton therapy leading up to the center coming online in the fall of 2019. For more on the care already provided at the Kimmel Cancer Center at Sibley, you can go to our website, hopkinscancerdc.org, and follow them on Twitter, at Sibley Online. As always, also follow both of our accounts on Twitter, at Hopkins Kimmel and at Bloomberg Kimmel. Thank you for listening.